Oh, no, not at all.
Parenting kind of a, I think you kind of parent each other.
Sure. And, you know, in a lot of ways, don't forget that a fair amount of your personality characteristics are genetically determined. And so you share, much to many people's chagrin, you share personality characteristics with your parents. Who's the folk singer? Greg Brown. Greg Brown is a musician, singer-songwriter. And he tells this story about his father and how he goes to meet him at the airport. And they were going to go on a fishing trip, and Greg Brown was, you know, really excited. He had gone out and bought a new hat for his fishing trip, and he was really proud of his new hat. And he went to the airport to pick up his dad, and his dad got off the airplane wearing the same damn hat. You know, independently, they had both bought new hats, and they both bought the same new hat. And he said he didn't, you know, he didn't used to like thinking about the fact that he was going to be like his father, but the older he got, the more he realized that he was going to be like his father, so he better like his father. Yeah, so, and that's, you know, when we talk about the idea, I've only had one girlfriend who actually was willing to explicitly admit that she was attracted to men who were like her father, and well, let me tell the rest of the story. And despite the fact that her father was a real asshole, yeah. And so, you know, here we go. So they pick people who may not be necessarily the nicest people, but people who fulfill some need that they have, whatever that is. But underlying that, the idea that her father was a real jerk, was the idea that, you know, we do share similarities. You know, there are some surface level differences that may differentiate fathers from children, but underlying personality characteristics, particularly the Big Five, when we look at Big Five traits, oftentimes we see high levels of correlation between that are predicted to a certain degree by genetics. Because we can look at twin studies, good. Right, remember from 201 how we use twin studies. Do you remember the two types of twins? Monozygotic and dizygotic. Identical twins are monozygotic, fraternal or dizygotic. And so we can look at monozygotic twins who, for whatever reason, were separated at birth and raised in different environments, and then measure their personality characteristics, and oftentimes we'll find a very high correlation.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but it's just kind of funny. I have twins in my family, girl and boy, and I've been asked, are they identical? Like, girl and boy. One's boy, what do you think?
It's kind of funny. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Yep. Yes. What we see is, you know, it's really hard to document, and it's really hard to validate. But there are cases of twins that independently, for example, I don't remember, there's like Jim and James, and independently they chose a house that was very similar. Their wives had the same name or something, and there's just these incredible, you know, litanies of similarities. But of course, you could take any random two people around the world and find the same kind of situation randomly occurring. So we would need to see it occurring at a rate higher than chance in order to put any credence in it. And I don't know what the studies have shown on that, but there are cases of twins that, you know, their cars are the same color and the same make, and, you know, and they haven't had contact for 50 years, you know. Yeah. Yeah. So that is one of the things we're going to talk about today, is romance and attraction and the role that similarity might play in those things. Any questions? Okay. Yeah, that'll help explain a lot of that. Yeah. There's, you know, all kinds of anecdotal stories of, you know, people who are not even related who have these incredible similarities. So I don't know. Yeah. Any questions on chapter 7? This is our last chapter together. How sad. Our last class for our final. Oh, the final exam, I'll be constructing it today, so I'll have the study guide available tonight. Apologies for people who might be taking it early. Yeah?
Will it be more on chapter 7 and 8, or pretty much
two? Okay, that's a good question. I haven't entirely decided how many questions there will be. There will be more than 30 multiple choice questions. It'll be composed entirely of multiple choice questions taken from the text, I think. I might take some from lecture, but I'll let you know on the study guide if that's the case. And about half of the questions will be from the prior, from the last couple chapters, and the rest will be from the previous chapters. So chances are there will be something like 60 questions on the exam, and 30 of them will be from the previous two chapters. Yeah, all multiple choice. Yeah, I don't have time to mark mark essays and things at the end of the term. It's too crazy before grades have to be filed. So, yep.
So don't cross. Wait, is the when's the final?
When is the final? It's on the calendar, Thursday. There's no class on Tuesday then if the final's on Thursday. Yeah, yeah. I don't even know when the final is. I'd have to look at the calendar myself.
Why not set the final on Tuesday?
Because some other class might schedule the final at this time period. No, not necessarily. What will happen is, for example, there might be a class that meets, I don't know, at noon or something on Tuesday, Thursday. And so they have to have one day for the 11 o'clock class and one day for the 12 o'clock class or something. However, if you check your catalog, you'll see that you are, if you have two, I think it's if you have more than two finals scheduled on the same day, you are not required to take the third on that day. The instructor can make accommodations for that. In addition, if for whatever reason you want to take the final earlier than Thursday, you're welcome to. Because I know that you may have, you know, a couple of finals scheduled, and if you want to space it out during the week, that's fine too. So, yeah, if you have a lot bunched up on one day, you want to check out your options. Other questions? Most, for the most part, people in this class are doing very well. You have a pretty high average in this class. So, congratulations. Okay, so So let's talk a little bit about, I sort of call this pro-social psychology, because a lot of what we've been studying up to this point have been either basic psychological processes in social psych or psychological processes that lead to problems in society, right? Prejudice, aggression, right? And so really up until the last 15 years or so, we haven't focused a lot on the sort of positive side of psychology. So there's actually a whole perspective in psychology which is known as positive psychology. Or not a not really a perspective, but a subdiscipline. And the idea behind positive psychology is we want to study not only behaviors that lead to problems, but what behaviors avoid those problems before they start. And so positive psychology will look at things like happiness, right? And so a number of researchers have been doing work in this area in terms of what makes people happy. And if you look in the literature, you will see that happiness in psychology is referred to not as happiness, because that would be too simple for psychologists. Instead, we call it subjective well-being, right? So if you want to look up happiness research, you'll have to look for subjective well-being. In addition to happiness, because happiness is a subjective experience. It's not an objective experience. The same, you know, the same circumstances for one person will be happy and for another will be unhappy, right? Spirituality has been of some interest to positive psychologists, and especially the notion, the relationships between spirituality and health, which, you know, borders into another subdiscipline, health psychology. And so, what else are, oh, love. You know, it's kind of bizarre that it's taken us almost 100 years in psychology to start tackling one of the most fundamental aspects of human behavior, right? What else? Positive psychologists study. I can't come up with a exhaustive list at this point. But so it gives you the idea that these kinds of topics have been less studied or less interesting to psychologists who were more interested in figuring out, social psychologists who were interested in figuring out how we could help solve some social problems. And so this is a growing field. It's getting more funding and more research, and it's a worthwhile field of study if you're interested in graduate work. Yeah. If you want to look at, if you're interested in happiness research, there's a few people. Ed Diener is one of the researchers in this area. Who else? Oh, Daniel Kahneman has been doing a lot of work in subjective well-being recently. He's the fellow, along with Amos Tversky, who developed the idea of the representativeness heuristic and the availability heuristics. Basically, heuristics as a shortcut for decision-making, and earned the Nobel Prize in Economics for that a few years ago. Diener and Kahneman, who else? I can't think of the other names at this point. So, yeah. basically, what makes people happy is not the usual list of suspects. It's not money, first of all. And physical attractiveness does not predict happiness, nor does money, physical attractiveness, and what's the other one I know about? What's that? No, I don't know about that. Health, oddly enough. Physical health doesn't predict happiness. So it's a bizarre kind of phenomenon. In fact, for the most part, almost everybody reports being happy. Whether they are living in a garbage dump in Mexico or they're living in Beverly Hills. Here's what we find, for example, when we look at data from Mexican culture, is an interesting thing to study because it has a wide disparity between the very poorest and the very richest people, something like the United States seems to be becoming. But basically, here's how it works. The bottom 20% and about the top 10% report being very unhappy or very happy. And then this 70% in here essentially report being happy. So it's kind of like what we do is think about the adaptation phenomenon. So people are very adaptable. And basically you put them in a situation and they find happiness in whatever situation they're in. We do see, for example, people who are downwardly mobile will be transiently unhappy. So they'll experience some unhappiness at their downward mobility, but once that downward mobility is stopped, they seem to report being happy. It's an interesting thing. Also, some of the work that Dan Kahneman has done, I don't know why I started talking about this, it's not really related, but I saw him talk when he came to UBC one time. And he talked about some research he did with colonoscopies. And anybody who's had a colonoscopy knows that it's a relatively unpleasant procedure, basically involves generally under some sort of a general sometimes a light general anesthetic, the insertion of a video camera through the anus into the rectum and then through the colon. And so it's not a particularly pleasant experience. And what he found was there were two ways that people experience pain in these colonoscopies. So one way would be, and this is pain and time. And so one way would be if, you know, they insert the colonoscopy equipment and the pain goes way up and they go through the procedure and the pain stays at a high level and then they get done with the procedure and the pain drops off. Another way they could do this procedure was to insert the colonoscopy instrument. The pain would be at a relatively high level. And then what they could do was they could reduce the pain slightly, I think by removing it part way, and then it would stretch out at this lower level, and then it would drop off. And what's interesting is the people in this condition reported less subjective pain than the people in this condition, even though they experienced more a longer duration of pain. And so what it turns out to be is the distance between the peak pain and the end of pain. The longer this is, the less subjectively painful it seemed to be. So it's very you know, we have some very interesting, weird findings out of social positive psychology. Yeah.
I think it's because the way that we perceive most of what we're experiencing is subjective and comparative.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What you're doing is probably comparing the peak pain to a little bit less and saying, oh, okay, this isn't so bad. I'm actually happy right here.
Mm-hmm.
You have to endure it longer, but it's a comparative kind of a perception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Okay, anyway, so let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. We'll see how long class lasts today. It might get out... Just kidding. I might get out early. She laughs. No, it's true. So here's a couple of quotes that I pulled out of a textbook that I have. If you wish to be loved, love. This is Hecato, I think a Greek philosopher, if I'm not mistaken. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, the only way to have a friend is to be one. Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's the quote from the Bible?
I think it's Proverbs 17:17.
Interesting. I didn't know that quote. I would put that up there. Yeah, I don't know if he gave attribution to it or if he plagiarized it. But so. So these are fundamental sort of ideas that we've been thinking about for a long time as human beings. How is it that we come to be liked by other people? How is it that we come to be appreciated? How is it that we come to be friends with other people? And so ultimately, this is going to get at why we form the bonds that we do, why we form the attractions we do, what might be the usefulness of liking other people, right? What is the usefulness of liking other people? So liking other people might help us feel good. In what way, do you think? Good. Okay, so if I like them, they might like me. And in fact, that's what the research shows. If you like someone, they will like you back. What else? Yeah. What's the usefulness of being liked?
Lack of isolation.
Good. So, we are social animals, as the textbook title suggests, and we form social bonds. And we find comfort in these social groups, don't we? But more than comfort, what else do we find in these social groups? Security, protection. So not only physical security, maybe even, but maybe emotional security or stability, right? Ostracism, as we know from studying earlier in the chapter, is one of the most powerful ways to influence somebody's behavior. When a prisoner is being a problem in a prison, where do they send him? Solitary confinement, right? And that's a brutal form of imprisonment. And that's why there are limits on how long people can stay in solitary. Yeah, question, yeah?
I think it reduces the stress and the tension that we tend to build up in everyday kind of animosities. If you have an enemy, then you've got to deal with unforgiveness and aggression. And when the person is your friend, you can reduce all of that.
Okay. So here's an idea, and I hadn't thought about this, that friendship is a tension reduction strategy. And I don't know the research on this.
Well,
not so much friendship, but a person that you have had conflict with and that turns around and likes you, right? We like those people a lot, right? So what else? Anything else you can think of? Why? What would be the usefulness of being liked?
Good.
Right. Self-esteem and self-concept. Good. You're thinking, you know, I really like this because you're thinking about all the topics that we've talked about for the past 10 weeks. So remember the idea that we engage in behaviors to bolster our self-esteem. So holding good, positive self-esteem is important for us. And when other people like us, we might feel more self-esteem.
Survival,
sure. So there's probably an evolutionarily valuable component to being liked by other people. So it might even, you know, you might even consider this kind of a normal behavior. Liking being a normal kind of behavior. And so then we talk about, for example, people with antisocial personality disorder as an abnormality. So people who, for example, when they hurt someone else, they don't have any remorse or any guilt or any conscience. People who, and then we talk about withdrawal as one of the problems of some psychological disorders, when people withdraw from their social networks and their social connections. So these social networks, social connections, liking, being liked, this is all really fundamental to what it is to be human and to be able to survive. So let's talk a little bit about liking other people. And we can't disentangle, we can, but it's liking other people is directly connected to being liked by other people. So these two things are interrelated, and they're going to affect each other, okay? Fundamentally, if I were to give you a broad overall statement about liking, interpersonal liking. We like people who like us. Okay? This is, you know, this is a basic broad umbrella statement. For example, what's interesting is we don't even have to have evidence that they like us. All we have to do is perceive that they like us. So just thinking that someone might like me actually causes me to like that person more, okay? And is going to change my behavior toward that person, yeah.
Would that, okay, I was just thinking the priming thing, that's what flashed in.
So priming, okay, good.
Is that we prime ourselves when we say just thinking someone likes me, not triggered by what someone tells me?
Good thought. That's a good thought. I hadn't thought about that. So the idea that thinking that someone likes me serves as a prime into associative networks of memories about liking and about being liked, and maybe just generates positive emotions. Sure.
So that's what that positive psychology thing is important too, because the power of positive thinking. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. And so think, you know, the idea that when we tend to think negative thoughts, reprogramming or or changing how we think about things has an effect on our behavior. And that's the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy in clinical psychology. When we're working, for example, with people who are depressed, oftentimes people who are depressed have a very dichotomous cognitive process. They think things are either great or they're awful, and there doesn't tend to be much in between. And so cognitive behavioral therapy is a lot about getting people to start thinking about that gray area in between, that life isn't just plain awful. There are some bad things about life, but there's also some good things, and starting to get them thinking more broadly and generally. Yeah, sure. And, you know, elementary school, junior high school, right? Think about the games kids play with telling so-and-so that, you know, she likes you, right? They don't directly say, I like you. They go through some intermediate, right? But here's the deal. You send the message, and the person may start to behave toward you in a liking way, and then that precipitates them liking the person more. So even if it's not true, you know, it begins this kind of cycle, and ultimately I feel liked, and then I like that person more.
Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, tell me about that. Much Ado About Nothing. How do you see the core connection?
Uh-huh. And hears that, and all of a sudden he's like, wow, she really likes me.
That's right.
So his attitude towards her starts changing, and they do the same thing to her, and her attitude starts changing,
yep.
And they end up getting married. Initially, they absolutely hate each other.
Shakespeare was a psychologist. Yep, and when we run research, we see that actually coming out. So I'll have to remember that. Maybe I'll have to try to pull some of the... pull some of the script of and see how that plays itself out. Yeah.
I'm not sure how true it is, but I feel like it might even actually work the opposite as well. Like if you have a person saying positive things about somebody as opposed to having to say negative things, that probably create bigger ravine between the two.
Yes, and we'll talk a little bit about this later, but here's what can happen. If all we hear from someone is how much they like us, we begin to question their ulterior motives for what they're saying, right? And so actually tempering that with some negative comments actually increases liking, yeah. Yeah. So actually, here's the deal. As Shakespeare does it, when people start out disliking each other and then they begin to like each other, that is like a snowball effect. It increases liking. Yeah.
Is that true for just like initial impressions or like in relationships?
Generally what we're talking about here is research on initial impressions. A lot of this is research with college students. You know, we'll sit them down and say, you know, we have another subject in another room, and you know, at the beginning of the exercise, at the beginning of the experiment, we'll have them write out a paragraph about their attitudes on some topic. And, you know, we'll have this other person in the room and we'll say, well, you know, here, let's exchange paragraphs. And of course, there is no subject in the other room. There's just a paragraph that either matches their attitudes or doesn't match their attitudes. So a lot of it is sort of initial liking, but there is some good research literature too. And most of that research literature will show that similarity is the important factor, how similar we are. Yeah.
So if you have like a friend, you should like be real nice and criticize them.
Oh yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that too. The idea that that things that stick out. So a criticism has much more weight than does a compliment. If you have a string of compliments and you have one criticism, it almost overshadows that whole previous string of compliments. So we tend to focus on these unusual things in our environment. You know, so how many of you, this may be dated, I don't know. How many of you went to the doctor's office or the dentist's office as a kid, and you opened, or maybe as an adult, and you opened up this magazine called Highlights? I've seen Highlights. Okay, good. So this is a relatively universal cultural experience. And what's the thing in the back of Highlights? The little picture? And what do you have to do with the picture? No. There's usually like one picture and you have to find something in the picture. Do you remember this? What things don't match, right? So there's these little exercises we do as kids that we find really fun, is to find the things that don't belong, right? And that's what we're good at. You know, we're really good at seeing things that are unusual or unique in our environment, because oftentimes those are maybe threatening stimuli, or they may be opportunities for reproductive success, perhaps, right? So, So anyway, we'll talk about that too. What's that?
I know. That was me too.
Huh?
We look at Highlights because we have kids.
Oh, because you have kids, yeah.
And that's, you just pick it up and see what's in it.
Yeah, and kids love those exercises of what's weird, what's unusual, you know, how can, picking out what's wrong here, right? Yeah, okay. So, here we go. So really, once we start this cycle of liking, what the problem is that even the slightest criticism, so if I give you 7 compliments and 1 criticism, you will like me a lot less than if I give you 8 compliments in a row, or 9 compliments, or even 10 compliments. You know, that one criticism will overshadow all that previous similarity, all that previous liking. Yeah. It does matter. If the criticism is followed by endorsement, then liking increases. But yeah, when a criticism comes later in the relationship, then it tends to have some pretty negative effects. Yeah. Say it again. Maybe I misunderstood what you said.
So earlier, I thought you said a person will actually grow to like somebody more if they aren't nice to them all the time.
If they initially start out disliking them, and there may be periodic disagreements, yeah. That'll increase liking a lot faster. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But this is when they start out liking.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we look for the things that don't match. You've got a string of compliments. I love you, I love you, I love you. You don't look so good in that dress. Bang, that's all gone. It doesn't matter how many I love yous came before it, right? Okay. Yeah, question, yeah.
Would that have to do with in that example, would that have to do with that individual's self-confidence?
I don't know how self-confidence or self-esteem moderates this. You know, we're looking at, this is data in general on populations, and there are going to be some moderators on these, and I just don't know what they are in terms of self-esteem and self-confidence.
I'd be thrown to space. So it's a good thing you're not wearing the dress. You know, if you don't like it or whatever.
Yeah.
But,
and again, think about individuals who are depressed.
Oh, yes.
So they're going to see things very polarized. And so these compliments are going to take on the quality of being intensely polarized. So any kind of individual differences are going to come to play here. But in general, that's how these processes work. Yeah. Yeah, but that's a good question. You're thinking critically. I like that. Okay. So liking. You know, it's 10 of. Why don't we take a break now? Come back about 12. Yep. Okay, so your question is, you know, we're reading this textbook, we're reading about these studies, and for the most part, you know, everything we, you know, up until about 1980, until the 1980s, 1990s, essentially everything we knew about human behavior came from studies of introductory psychology students at major research universities in North America, for the most part the United States, right? So you're asking a question about what concept in psychology, in research methods? Do you remember what it's called? No, what's the concept in research methods that has to do with our ability to take the results of one study in one population and apply it to other populations? It does, but what's the concept in research methods? You remember? Referred to as generalizability. And so one of the concerns in research is if we take a study from a particular population, so let's say we want to study, let's say we want to study the effects of aging on memory. What population would we choose to study? Okay, so we might study the population of aging individuals. Okay, so older people generally. You know, we might start out in basic research to find out what memory looks like at different ages. So we might take, for example, 10-year-olds, and then we might take 20-year-olds, and then we might take 30-year-olds, and 40-year-olds, and 50-year-olds, and 60-year-olds. And then we could compare between those groups. Let's say that we want to study interpersonal liking. What population would you choose to study? Okay. Okay, so you might be able to reasonably make the argument that we want to study people who are more likely to be forming new relationships rather than people who have existing relationships. That's a reasonable argument. Okay, let's say we want to study love. What population would you want to take your sample from? Good. So people in different types of, so basically everybody, right? Okay, so here's the deal. Someone who is, you know, 45 or 50 years old, has a career, you know, is making good money, how am I going to get them to come into a lab and sit through an hour or 2 hours worth of experiments so I can study their behavior? You're not, essentially. You have to pay them a lot of money. And that research is going to be incredibly expensive, right? Okay. So for convenience, we use free research subjects who usually will get course credit for participation in research. So if you go to a major university, you don't do that at the community college. And one of the reasons why I like to have my students actually do some experiments is to get used to the research process, like you did upstairs yesterday, or last Monday. Here's what we do. We take intro psych students and we say, in order to successfully complete this, 5% of your course grade is based on research participation. And you have to participate in 3 research studies over the course of the term. And so so that's our source of free subjects, essentially. I just participated in a research study for the Arizona State University, their Department of Communications, I think, looking at testicular cancer survivors and how writing about their experiences affects them in some way. I don't actually know what the hypothesis is, obviously. But they had to pay me $100, right? And so if you want to get, 300 or 400 subjects at $100 a pop, that's a serious amount of money. And research grants don't come easy. And oftentimes the grants will say you can't pay your subjects because actually paying subjects creates a self-selection bias. The people who are in the research are the ones that need to get paid for it. So now you've got a whole nother criteria there. So we're always trying to balance the practicality of research with generalizability. So here's the deal. In almost all psychological research, we want to be able to generalize to everybody in the world. We want to find universal causes of behavior. But we can't realistically... So we talked about the population, which is the group that you're going to draw your what from? Sample. Right? And we can't realistically sample from all 7 billion people in the world. I can't realistically sample randomly from that 7 billion, can I? I would have to, give them all a plane ticket to fly to my university in Ohio and put them up in a hotel and feed them and, run them through experiments and then fly them back home. We don't have the resources to do that. So what we have to do is we have to sample from some population that we have available to us. And in most research, it's, university students. The nice thing is that we are now starting to take samples not only from North American students, especially if we think that these basic psychological processes may have some cultural influence. We will now collaborate with another researcher at Kyoto University in Japan and run the same research at the same time in both universities. And now we have a broader base for generalizing. But generalizability is always a problem. And it's a reasonable criticism of psychological research. In the physical sciences, particles work the same. Well, okay, I can't say that anymore. I was going to say particles work the same everywhere, but now with all this weird string quantum whatever stuff, things get, there are multiple dimensions and they work differently in these different dimensions and all kinds of stuff. But in classical physics, particles are particles, parts are parts. In psychology, people ain't people. We're all different. So it's a very difficult process in psychology. And it's a reasonable criticism of a lot of the research. But the only way we can start understanding things is to find basic findings like this in North America and then in college-age students and then start replicating those experiments in other populations to see if we get the same results. Or if we don't get the same results, then we start looking at what are the moderating variables in those populations that may affect our results, okay? Bingo. Yeah. So so one of the things that I've been trying to do with Portland State is I've been trying to talk to them about running their experiments here on the campus here, on you know, getting a broader variety of students. But one of the problems when you start doing that is you introduce variability in the data, because now you've got all kinds of other variables that you need to take into account, you know, how old they are, you know, we always take that into account anyway, but, you know, their previous life experience and so on and so forth. So the nice thing about college students is they're, you know, a relatively homogeneous group of subjects that we can test these basic processes on and then try and branch out from them into more easily generalized populations, yeah. Yeah.
So you're 5
yep.
Or 85.
Yep.
So taking so, sampling from such a random group, you can find, well, this person, you know, this old but still, you know, reacts this way, and the same thing with 18-year-old, I would think then, you know, you'd save yourself a lot of steps. You know, there's definitely a correlation going on here because these two people have nothing to do with each other.
Okay. So again, yeah. So again, you're saying, why, okay, I didn't mean to talk about this long, but we can. Why do a study in one smaller population and then replicate it instead of starting out in the big population in the first place? What is a diverse community?
All ages?
Yeah, all backgrounds? Where are we going to find that?
At a community college more than a university.
Okay. We have, I think, the median age here is, I think the median is 28 or 29. But, so where are the 60-year-olds? You said all ages. Okay, and what does a broader age range introduce into your data? Variability. And here's the game. Okay, you're living in a you're coming at this from an ideal world, and I applaud you for thinking idealistically about research. Here's the game. I get a grant for 1 year. $20,000 to run a series of experiments. If I don't publish one or two articles from that data from that grant, I don't get another grant. And the more variability I have in my data, the less likely it's going to be publishable because I won't get significant results. Okay? So what this leads to, the way that we've set up the research enterprise and the funding process in this country, it leads to people doing very small experiments in very small subsets of people. And, hold on a second, and so what we get is what we used to do, you know, a lot of the older research you're reading about in these books, in the 1940s, 1930s, 1920s, these were grand experiments looking at, you know, big topics. And now the experiments that are published are very, you know, when I go to do my PhD research, I'm going to be studying social conflict situations in a particular subset of the population and a particular kind of outcome from those, you know. And so my publications are going to be very tightly focused. And so what we're getting is lots of articles about very small things that have to be then taken and aggregate it into something big. I'm not going to say that that's the wrong way to do science. I think, you know, a more efficient way to do science would be if the United States government said, well, we don't want to pay a bazillion grad students, you know, a bazillion dollars to run all these little experiments so we can find out something generalizable. Why don't we just take a bazillion dollars and run the big experiment on everybody? Why don't we? Well, first of all, how do you get the bazillion dollars? You can only do so much in 1 year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm getting at is the idea that that this is the best we have under the current state of research. Yeah. Question.
And it seems like it would be easier if you had like a small sample that like there aren't a lot of other variables, like to add variables to, like as somewhere to start and build up on, introduce new variables one at a time.
Yeah. Yes, it is in a lot of ways a better way to conduct science is to start with the most controlled circumstances and then start building from there and seeing what's the variability in these in tightly controlled circumstances and how can we explain that. And that leads to looking at some other process and that leads to looking at another process. And then so it kind of branches out from these very tightly controlled studies into a mass of literature about some basic process that we can then draw generalizable conclusions about and test those generalizable conclusions in the bigger population. So, you know, it's really just two ways to get at the same thing. You could start in the big generalizable population and start finding out that there are lots of variables you need to control and then run experiments to try to control those variables and see if they're causal, right? So, yeah. Do you have a question? Okay. Does that answer your question about generalizability and research? Maybe more than you wanted to know.
You know, and then in another section, we have to remember that, okay, you're in this age bracket, you're going to have these other life issues and deal with. It was just, how do you, I was just really concerned that we based everything on the select group. So it's not really valid.
Yeah, it's a probabilistic science. It is not a deterministic science. Yeah. Physics, you know, gravity works the same way essentially. Well, under classical physics, gravity works the same way everywhere. Under psychology, behavior doesn't work the same way everywhere, right? Or at every point in time. So, it's a difficult science. So maybe that's one of the reasons. So when we think about liking, one of the things we have to think about is attribution. So one of the fundamental ideas in social psychology is how we explain other people's behavior, attribution, right? So you read about the fundamental attribution bias, the ways that we try to explain people's behavior. So when somebody likes us, we try to explain their liking, right? It's not good enough to say, oh, they like us, yay. We're human beings and we want to draw attributions about other people's behaviors. So we're going to say, why are they being kind? If we can convince ourselves at least that they don't have an ulterior motive in being nice to us, then we will be more likely to accept their flattery. Okay. But we're always kind of cautious about that ulterior motive, aren't we? Right. For the most part, what's that? Do we learn it? Sure. I mean, how would you know? The only way you could know would be to isolate a baby at birth and see if they develop, caution about ulterior motives. Yeah. I have to head off that automatic response. It is not. Remember. Remember what Aronson says about crazy things people do. Do you remember in the beginning of the book? What did he say? Just because people do crazy things doesn't mean they're crazy. Yeah. All other things being equal, again, there are going to be individual difference variables in different populations that might affect these results. However, you know, for example, openness to new experience, people's general level of trust that they have in other people. Have they had the experience in life of having that trust violated? And are they cautious? Okay, so there are individual difference variables. But all other things being equal, we try to eliminate ulterior motives in other people's behavior. Yeah, yeah. If we can convince ourselves or gather enough evidence that there is not an ulterior motive. We also like to gain other people's esteem. And one of the things that convinces us that we have gained someone else's esteem is when they initially disapprove of us or don't like us, and then they subsequently change their evaluation of us. Okay? And then, oops, I have a spelling error in there. And then so we tend over time to really like people a lot when we perceive that we have somehow gained esteem in their eyes. In some way, they've gone through a deliberative process and have come to like us after not liking us in the beginning. Okay. So, how are we going to know if someone doesn't like us or disapproves of us or has or doesn't have ulterior motives? When you meet somebody, how do you know these things? Through their behavior, right? They're going to send you lots of nonverbal communication as well as verbal communication. About their appraisal of you. So in order to even get to this point, you have to be close to people, don't you? You have to be in contact with them. You have to interact with them. And so one of the main features of liking behavior and of pro-social psychology is the idea of proximity. When we look at studies from sociology, one of the things that we find is that there are some overpowering variables that have an effect on the people that we're likely to get married to. First of all, we are more likely, in general, to get married to people who live in the same neighborhood as we do. Now, what does that imply? What other variables come with being in the same neighborhood? Yeah. Hold on a second. What's that? So you may have common friends. What else? Good. So, you know, you both live in the same geographic area, so maybe you're more likely to run into them. What else? Good. Socioeconomic status, culture is likely to be similar in the similar neighborhood. So there's a lot of similar characteristics of people that live in the same neighborhoods. Or you can work in the same company or just in the same occupation even. Okay? So generally people, you know, working in the same company are going to come into contact with each other regularly. If they're working in the same occupation in the same geographic area, they may be likely to come into contact with each other through, professional groups or conferences or things like that. You might marry somebody in this class, but more likely you'll marry somebody who sits in a number of your classes in college. I think the highest... one of the things that predicts marriage is being at the same university as an undergraduate. I don't think it works for graduate school. Or, guess what? You hang out at the bar down the street or the cafe down the street. Okay? So from sociology, we can get a pretty good idea that there's something about geography that's gonna affect the people that you come to like, the people that you associate with, and ultimately maybe the people that you get married to. But it's not entirely about geography. The term that's used when they talk about proximity is the idea of functional distance. Basically, how frequently do we meet? How frequently do we cross each other's path? Do we see each other? You don't even have to meet the person. You know, you just have to pass by them walking across campus enough times. You just have to, you know, run into each other in the library or see each other studying in the same place at the same time. If you want to get to meet somebody romantically, you might try to finagle your schedule so that it overlaps with that person's, right? We've all done that. It's almost a little bit stalking, but maybe not in a negative way, right? So proximity, yeah. So one of the questions that researchers have looked at then is when we look at this functional distance and the interaction that comes with low functional distance, what is it that it does for us that increases how much we like people? Well, first of all, remember we said that we like people who like us, so we have to be around people to get a sense that they like us. And then we might start to like them back. In addition, it allows us, you know, if we're hanging out at the same cafe, we may be able to start talking about our similarities. What things that we both enjoy that are similar. The club, you know, I belong to a pottery club. So it's obvious that we both enjoy pottery, and I'm sitting next to somebody at a wheel, and I say, gee, I notice your T-shirt. It says Motley Crue. I really like Motley Crue, too. No, I don't. But I don't know if I do. I haven't listened enough to their music. And then what happens also is it allows people to perceive of themselves as connected in this social unit. And that cohesiveness and that in-groupness we tend to feel good about. And we start to feel more comfortable with the individual. But it's not just about the actual interaction either. Here's another factor that comes into play in proximity, which is, guess what? I get to anticipate running into that person crossing campus. And that anticipation itself actually breeds liking. Not only is it direct interaction, but the anticipation that you are going to be exposed to this person in the future. You're going to be exposed to their ideas. You're going to be associated with them in some way, yeah?
This anticipation, is that
Good question. So elaborate on that, yeah. Okay.
And then the anticipation that the arranged marriage is going to happen, does that breed the liking?
So the question is, in arranged marriages, sometimes the people will be proximally distant. They'll be living in separate countries even. They will not have had the chance to do actual interactions together very much. And so some arranged, you know, I don't know what the percentage is of arranged marriages that people actually feel loved, satisfied, versus arranged marriages where they feel that they're just part of a social or cultural unit. And so those people that do feel loved or like their partner or love their partner, how much of that is anticipation? That's a good question. I don't know if it's been addressed in the research. I haven't seen anything. Okay.
Marriage is supposed to be sure. Overseas than as we do here.
Sure.
We think that it has to involve a lot of dispositional similarity.
Okay.
And overseas you make a commitment
good.
To somebody and that's your basis for sticking with them.
Good point. So, you know, here we get now to this idea of generalizability and cultural differences and how do we say that this is going to be true in India where marriage the concept of marriage is just really quite different. What function marriage serves in our own individual lives, whether it functions to, you know, that we can by our in the United States in individualistic cultures we tend to see love as very self-oriented, right? Whereas in these collectivist cultures it may be seen very differently. I'm not sure. Family, or I would say even a broader cultural unit. It kind of gets at this idea of, I don't want to get too far off on this, but when you talk about female genital mutilation, or what's called sometimes female circumcision, and certain cultures, particularly in Africa, practice the surgical removal of the clitoris, or at least the head of the clitoris, which is exposed, and then the labia are sewn shut in a lot of cases too. And so this practice is aberrant to North Americans, but in those cultures it actually serves a purpose of kind of unifying those women. You know, they feel this almost led to the breakdown of the Congress for Women's Rights in Beijing in 1999, when people from cultures that didn't practice genital mutilation or female circumcision, the women from those cultures sort of accused the women of barbarism who were in these cultures that practiced it. And the women from those cultures said, no, you've got it wrong. We actually feel better about ourselves, right? So their self-esteem is higher because they've played a part in this cultural process, right? Even though it's individually detrimental. So, you know, it's a very different way of seeing your experience. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the statistics are, and I'm sure they're hard statistics to get because there may be cultural mores against speaking out against the practice or whatever. But you know, certainly the women who went to the Congress are not, you know, ignorant, you know, women who don't have a choice either. So there is some element of cognitive dissonance. Good. You're starting to think like social psychologists. I like it. Okay, here's what happens when when you are on the losing side of an election, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, what will eventually happen is, for the most part, those voters who didn't win will come to like the candidate who did win, even though they started out disliking that candidate. Okay. That doesn't mean there aren't individual differences, and there aren't people that are going to hold a grudge. There are going to be those people, but all other things being equal, and probably in college-age populations, they're going to come around. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about proximity. So one of the factors that's going to come into play, as I said, is just seeing someone else. And you don't even have to like that person, because it works with just ambiguous stimuli. And I could have done this throughout the course of the term. I should have. I like to run this in classes sometimes. Periodically through the term, I could flash on the screen some ambiguous word that, you know, doesn't exist in English. And at the beginning of the term, I could give you a list of ambiguous words and ask you to tell me which ones you liked better. And at the end of the term, if, let's say, I flashed that on the screen a couple times every class period, at the end of the term, I would give you that same list of ambiguous words and say, which ones do you like better? And you'll say the word that we, that word will suddenly pop up in the liked words. And what's also interesting is the mere exposure effect seems to work partly at a level below consciousness. So if I flash something subliminally on the screen, for example, so let's say I show it to you for 10 milliseconds, which is about the limit of your conscious awareness of things that you see, then I will get a stronger effect of liking it. So it's almost like all you have to do is glance at people in your environment, and you'll start to like them more because you've seen them more. Okay. So there's this just general effect of the social environment, yeah. Sure. There's a lot of...
Let's say a year's, like biology, say a year's, year's 2011, 12, 13, for example, and over the classes, people would get more friendly.
Sure. 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 So in group membership, it's also going to have, they're all self-selecting into those classes. So, you know, they're self-selecting themselves into a group of people who like biology, you know, maybe, I don't know. Yeah. Sure. Sure. And that's, you know, that's why, you know, presidential candidates buy a lot of ad time. They want to show you their face over and over and over. That's why, you know, Apple runs iPod commercials on TV every half hour. They want to show you that image over and over and over. That one, that Apple logo that's on the laptop back there, is the number one most widely recognized commercial symbol in the world right now. And that's partly due to mere exposure. Yeah. You don't have to know much about the products or the company, but that symbol becomes liked. The dark side of mere exposure is lack of exposure. And so what that means is outgroups we are wary of. People or groups that we that we don't get exposed to are going to start to become threatening. Okay. You know, and that what's that? And prejudice, sure. Sure. So that's a good argument. This is some data that provides a good argument for, integration of schools right? Not segregated schools. Yeah. Okay, so that's proximity. Let's talk a little bit about similarity. I think I'll finish with similarity. Do opposites attract? So who says? Not social psychologists, right? The overwhelming data do not support the notion that opposites attract, either romantically or any other way. But remember, when someone starts out disliking you and they come to like you, you'll get to like them. So if someone starts out with an opposite opinion and they come around to your attitude, then you may start to like them more. But in general, similarity is a stronger factor. Birds of a feather do flock together, okay? Yeah. So this is, you know, what social psychologists have to tell us. Birds of a feather do flock together. Likeness does lead to liking. Again, you like people who like you, but you also like people who are like you. And again, it doesn't even have to be an actual likeness. All we have to do is create the perception or the illusion that someone is like you, and that will increase your chance that you'll like this other person. Here's some interesting data. Tanya Chartrand was at New York University, and then she went to Ohio State, and now she's somewhere else. I don't know where she is now. She did some research on mimicry. And so she would set up situations where Confederates would subtly mimic the expressions of the people that they were interacting with. And when she set up these situations, people liked people who did the mimicry more than people who didn't. So, it's like the job interview thing. Which is that? Yep. 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 Mimic the job interview. We do this spontaneously in dating. You know, when we make videotapes of people who are on a first date. The ones who are likely to continue dating are the ones that like each other after the date. Typically, when one person scratches their face, the other scratches their face. When one person brushes their hair back, not long after, the other will. When one person raises their eyebrows, the other one will. So there's this interactive kind of thing that we're sending a signal to each other that we want to be in rapport, right? Yep. Yeah, right.
I just have this long position this morning. I was like, I talked to him in the last few weeks, you know, about speaking French too. I was so impressed. You know, I was like, what country are you from? I'm not from my country because I have this pretty accurately mimicking the accent. And so they think, you know, it's either a talent that you have, you're an American, but you don't sound like an American when you speak French.
Oh, no, that's common.
So, like, but then my son said,
everybody does it. Well, you're searching for attributions, right? That's what we just talked about, the idea that you're searching out for their ulterior motive to see whether they have this ulterior motive. Oh, everybody does it. Yeah, it's a natural part of interaction. All of us, when we go into another culture where they speak a dialect of English that's different from ours. When I go down south, guess what? I start speaking more Southern, right? We do this. This is our way of forming social bonds because those are important to us in a social context. Yeah. EHarmony. EHarmony works because it capitalizes on an intense process of, I think, I actually did EHarmony. That's how I met my fiance.
Nice.
And we're going to get married. And so, you know, this data actually comes from studies. It's not just marketing material for EHarmony. I actually, when I was going to internet date, because I lived in South Carolina, and I didn't get out in the culture much, so I wasn't going to have a proximity effect with people very much, so I wanted to do some internet dating. And I actually looked at all the services. I looked at Match.com, Perfect Match, what are the other ones? I kind of looked at Yahoo Personals. And a lot of them are sort of based, like Match.com especially is one of the heavy marketed ones, is based on looking at people's pictures and picking out who you want to date. And they're more oriented at sort of casual dating rather than intense matching of traits. And so when I looked at eHarmony's system and at their methods, it seemed like the most methodologically sound of all the ones out there. And it is based on matching up people on their values and their attitudes. And that will tend to predict liking, but it also tends to predict relationship satisfaction. And that, you know, this basic data comes from research on relationships, and then the eHarmony method is currently, one of the criticisms of the eHarmony is that they haven't published their methodology in any journals for peer review, but it's obviously, you know, a trade secret that they don't want to reveal.
It's also interesting because you can't see their picture unless they request it.
Oh, that's right.
There's no, like, base. It's not based on initial attraction.
Yeah, they actually, the picture availability is actually something that tends to come later in the process, yeah. Yeah. And so, and one of the other reason I used eHarmony is because when I looked at the statistics at the time that I did it, which was about 3 years ago, they had about 2-to-1 women to men, so I figured my chances were a lot better. You know, I'm a statistician, so I like to, you know, I like to look at the statistics. In addition to birds of a feather flocking together, birds that have different feathers will oftentimes attack each other, partly because we have this false consensus bias. And the false consensus bias is that we tend to think that other people think like we do. We want to think that, you know, our way of thinking is how everybody thinks. And it turns out that that's not usually the case. And so what happens is this attitude dissimilarity actually has a stronger effect on disliking than similarity does on liking. So again, it's like that process where one criticism can undo a whole lot of compliments, right? This works especially in in-groups. And but when we look at attitude alignment over time, it tends to promote stronger relationships, but it also tends to, we also tend to overestimate how much similarity in attitude we have. So we'll tend to start thinking we're more similar based on other characteristics than the ones that we actually see. So false consensus, yeah. That's all I have time for today, but I will send out a study guide hopefully tonight. I'll send you a link to it. Any questions, you know where to find me. If you are confused, you just want to talk, you want to vent, you can get me in my office. What's that?
Do you have a date?
A date for what?
For
getting married? No, I don't. We have to live in the same place for a while.
So is that why you're moving to Phoenix?
No, I'm not moving to Phoenix. I was accepted into a graduate program at the University of Arkansas for next year, so I'll be doing my PhD in social psychology there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I'm going to have a $10,000 a year fellowship and about $10,000 for being a teaching assistant. And 3 or 4 years, maybe I'll be back here with a PhD. Who knows?
PhD.
Yeah. Well, most instructors here do have their PhDs, yeah. Yeah. Huh?
Yeah,
yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm really happy about it. I'm sad to leave all you behind, but I'm really happy about it. Okay, so have a good weekend. I'll see you next week. Yep. Let's see. I am giving another final on Tuesday at 3:00. Can you make that one?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Then what I'll do is I'll leave it in the division office in Social Science 215. Please send me an email to remind me because I'll forget otherwise.
Okay.
Okay.
Might want to do the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, just send me an email. Okay. That'll be fine. Yep. Last day.
I know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.